James Buchan joins us now. He's a former Middle East correspondent, novelist, and author of Days of God, The Revolution in Iran and Its Consequences. James, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
You first went to Iran in 1974. What was it like then to show up there?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that, Rod.
You first went to Iran in 1974. What was it like? What was your first impression there?
Well, I arrived there because I was a student of I was studying Persian at university in England, and it was just after the oil price hike. In the winter of 73-74, oil prices went up fourfold, and Britain just turned off its power stations, and people were laid off and had to work just 3 days a week. And what struck me most arriving in Iran was that all the lights were on, that the country was going through a boom because it was on the receiving end of all this oil revenue. And I'd left Europe in darkness, and I arrived in this country where everything was bright.
Did it feel like a place that was just 5 years from a major revolution?
Well, to be honest, I thought that Iran was going to hell. I really did. But I couldn't, I didn't, you know, I was 18, 19 years old. I didn't have the understanding to see what sort of hell it was heading for. And it was really then that I first thought of writing about the place. But it took many, many years for me to gather the understanding to be able to do it.
How did the movement against the Shah of Iran develop? Why were Iranians frustrated with him?
Well, the royal house that the Shah belonged to, they were called Pahlavi, was a quite recent foundation. His father seized the throne in 1925 and embarked, both father and son, on the rapid industrialization and modernization of what was a very, very backward traditional country. And they went about it, as we say in England, like a bulleted gate. They and brooked no opposition. And they suppressed parliamentary government, turned the press into a group of sycophants, and repressed dissent, so that Iranians who felt they were being torn this way and that by the very rapid development of the country also felt that they were being turned into infants, turned into children by the Shah. And the regime was very unpopular. It's just that in comparison to what followed, the Pahlavi era looks like a golden age of prosperity and justice in comparison to the Islamic Republic that came into being in 1979, which has not been successful at all, and particularly not in the areas where the Pahlavis were successful, which is in the development of the economy.
Well, at the time, a lot of people didn't see a close link between Shiite Islam and politics. In fact, as you write, I think there was a discomfort in the role of the Shia movement with direct involvement of politics. How did it become such an important role in the revolution and then in the ruling of the Islamic Republic?
Well, it was through the personality of Khomeini and his character and his unbending will. Shia Islam is pretty dynamic in the way it interprets Muslim scripture, and he devised a theory of government. Khomeini did while he was in exile. He was exiled by the Shah in 1964. He developed a theory of government in which power would be devolved to the clergy, and they would run the country. And this turned out to be a bit of a surprise to the secular opponents of the Shah, But they could see in the course of mass demonstrations in 1978 that Khomeini was pretty good at mobilizing the masses. And so they were happy to go along with the religious movement. What they didn't foresee was that after the Shah went into exile in 1979, there would be essentially a civil war in which Khomeini and his circle destroyed all opposition in Iran, the left, the sort of centrist nationalists, and the secular forces, in order to enforce his vision of what Islamic government should be. And that's an error that, you know, the millions of Iranians in exile still brood over in Britain and, you know, Germany and, you know, in California.
And at this point in global history, when you rebelled against a Western allied autocracy, usually it was either a nationalist movement that ended up taking over or a communist movement taking it over. This was a new animal, wasn't it? This Islamic theocracy.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and in a way, Rod, it was also a harbinger of the end of the Cold War. Because if one could imagine if a leftist government had taken power in 79 in Iran when the Shah left, that leftist government would have been left high and dry 10 years later when the Soviet Union fell to bits. So the Iranian Revolution was pointing to the new era, which was slightly overlapping with the Cold War, but pointing to the post-war Cold War era, in which there would be this new Islamic radicalism, which would select for its enemy, you know, the United States, and you know, and that has lasted for you know, for 30 years. There was a particular problem with Iran in that Khomeini destroyed the Shah's army, which he did for reasons where, one can understand. He destroyed the Shah's army by, you know, shooting 400 generals. But in doing that, he profoundly altered the balance of power in the Middle East.
And we'll pick up that point in just a moment, James. We're talking to James Buchan. He's author of Days of God, The Revolution in Iran and Its Consequences. In just a few minutes, we'll talk about what happened after that balance of power shifted. First, I'm Rob Ferret, here with Veronica Rickert and Jean Purcell. It's our fall membership drive.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this is the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive, and we're here to let you know how important your support is. Your gift makes a huge difference. It's actually what powers the engine of Wisconsin Public Radio. Step up and be counted as a supporter with your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Now, last hour, we heard from, it looks like, about 23 of you. Thanks so much for those calls, for those pledges of support. We really appreciate each and every one of them. And with the new hour, we've got a brand new goal. Before 6 o'clock, we need to get 35 pledges. So let's get started now. Help us meet this goal by making a contribution at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. And don't forget, the programs you enjoy will be here every day in Wisconsin Public Radio, thanks to your gift.
What happens in the rest of the world matters to us here, and that's why Wisconsin Public Radio is so important. We talk with experts like James Buchan in all kinds of fields from all over the world.
That's right, and we do it because getting the news from around the world and then bringing it to our own backyard is important, and we cover news from our backyard too, by the way. Because you value being an informed citizen, make a pledge to the station that keeps you connected. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Supporting Wisconsin Public Radio right now is a great thing to do with just a few minutes of your time, because that's really all it takes to become a member, just a few minutes of your time. You give us your name, you supply your contact information, decide how much you'd like to give, and how you'd like to pay. And whether you call or you pledge online, we always keep your personal information safe. We never share it with anybody else.
Nope, we never do that. And it's a reminder that your gift supports the stories, the programs like Central Time that keep you connected to the world. So give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Many of us are committed to making our communities better places. For example, maybe you volunteer your time, maybe you recycle, or maybe you help those in need. Making a financial contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio is another thing that makes our communities better.
Yeah, it really does. And your investment, and it really is an investment, together with the donations from others, make this news, this music, and talk available on WPR to everyone. We're proud to be an important part of the Wisconsin community of listeners, so help us stay strong with your pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace. Every weekday morning, I get in my car,
NPR's business news,
and I go to work. A few hours of, and then I get to go home.
This is all.
But what if one day I'd feel like there was something missing, and I know you'd feel that way too. So please consider a sustaining membership to keep public radio going strong. Here's how to contribute, and thanks.
Pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm here with Jean Purcell. We're asking for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio during this fall membership drive. Maybe you're looking at your budget. You think, well, we can afford $10 a month. Maybe you can afford $20 a month. Well, whatever amount you decide is the right amount at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we do pledge drives like this asking for your support because we don't expect any one or even 100 listeners to carry the costs of this program, of this radio network. In fact, we believe that there is an advantage to having the bulk of our budget come from thousands of listeners just like you.
When we have that wide base of support, it really does make for a more stable organization. And when you pledge, it also lets us know something else. It lets us know that you value the programs that you get from Wisconsin Public Radio. So join in. Become a member. You decide the amount. $5 a month is a great starting place. And then pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
So maybe you donated a few years ago, like back in 2009, and you're listening to us right now and you think, you know what, I've done my part. But here's the thing, you've been listening day in and day out to WPR year after year since that pledge you made back in 2009. It's your continued support right now that keeps this organization strong.
Well, if it has been a while since you donated, this is the perfect time to rejoin at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and we're really glad to have you back.
Absolutely. We'd love to welcome you back, and you can be one of those folks that helps us make our goal of just 32 more pledges before 6 o'clock, and we've got about 40 minutes to make them, so plenty of time and plenty of room for you. You fund the programs you rely on when you give right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And thank you. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're back now with James Buchan. He's former Middle East correspondent, novelist. His new book is Days of God, The Revolution in Iran and Its Consequences. James, just before the break there, you mentioned Iran's military being in disarray after the revolution. And then their neighbor, Saddam Hussein, leader of Iraq, thought he saw an opportunity. The war that ensued, how did that affect Iran?
Rob, you're quite right. I mean, the first consequence was, of course, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan on at Christmas time in 1979. It's hard to imagine the Soviets going ahead with that if the Iranian army had still been at full strength. But just going to Saddam's invasion in 1980, that had the effect of stiffening the resistance of Iran and causing Iranians to rally behind their leaders. I mean, it was regarded at the time by some of the revolutionaries as a godsend. It also, the 8 years' war with Iraq, it also provided an atmosphere of crisis during which it was which permitted Khomeini to destroy his eternal enemies. So even though the effect of the war was shattering, in that something like 200,000 Iranians lost their lives, and after 8 years of war, it just went back to the status quo. Even though it did a great deal to solidify the revolution.
Did it bring a nationalist sentiment for people who might not have supported the theocracy but wanted to support their country against this foreign invader?
Yes, exactly that. I mean, the Iranians, as you know, are not Arabs and don't get on particularly well with the Arabs, and the feeling is pretty well mutual. There's a strong sense of, you know, Iranianness or Persianism. Of course, some Iranians in the course of the war left the country, but there was a great rallying behind the Islamic Republic. And there was a great deal of heroism shown on the battlefront. It's just a pity that the Iranian soldiers weren't better led. But like the First World War.
And another important chapter, of course, for us in the United States was the taking of hostages at the American embassy. What led up to that? There's been some people have viewed it as a very conscious, intentional policy on behalf of the leaders of the revolutionaries. Others as kind of this almost chaotic chain of events. What led up to that?
Well, I've come to the conclusion that the second is true. That the occupation of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, November the 4th, 1979, emerged out of the chaotic student politics of the time, and that Khomeini, when he was confronted with it and saw how popular it was, sided with the occupiers, with the hostage takers. And it was at that point that anti-Americanism, which was essentially a sort of leftist posture, you know, which still survives in sort of fossilized form in Iran long after it's been driven out, chased away pretty well everywhere else. That's when anti-Americanism became established as the principal pillar of the Islamic Republic. And as its main political posture, even though it in no way corresponds to the feelings of ordinary Iranians who are interested in the United States and quite enthusiastic about it.
How important was it that the United States had admitted the Shah of Iran, now in effect in exile after this revolution, the United States took him in?
It was completely unimportant, Rob. In a meeting, when Khomeini was in exile just outside Paris, in a meeting with a French diplomat who'd carried a message from President Carter, Khomeini asked the Americans to take the Shah. That was in early in 1979. So in the course of 8 or 9 months, he'd thoroughly changed his mind. It was a piece of, in many ways, typical of Khomeini. It was a piece of political opportunism, but the Islamic Republic is saddled with this anti-Americanism, it's going to, you know, it's in a mess now, and it's going to have to find some way out of it.
I've referred a couple times to Iran as a theocracy, yet we see elections for president of Iran, other elections there. How do the clergy exercise their control in Iran?
Rob, it's actually a hybrid Iran. It's a hybrid of a parliamentary democracy and a clerical dictatorship, and the contradictions between the two often produce strains and look to me to becoming intolerable in the end. It has regular elections, and these elections often throw up very, very surprising results, of which the most surprising of all was this landslide back in June of this year in the presidential election for this gentleman, not at all well known, Hassan Rouhani. The elections are tightly controlled. Only certain candidates can be put forward whose Islamic credentials are beyond dispute. But even so, it is, you know, if the definition of a democracy is it can turn up surprise results, well, then Iran is a democracy. It's not quite a democracy, not quite a theocracy.
Just in our last minute, I want to touch on Iran's nuclear ambitions. You mentioned a case that I hadn't heard before. Iran, the leaders of Iran, are suspicious of the idea of having a powerful standing army, so they maybe view the nuclear deterrent as better than building up conventional armed forces.
Well, Rob, that's completely correct. The Iranian armed forces in an offensive role are very weak. In a defensive role, they'd be something to reckon with. But when Iran began on this course of nuclear research back at the end of the 1990s, I don't think anybody realized that they would end up betting the farm on it, and that it would lead to the current situation in which the a mixture of incompetence and Western and United Nations sanctions has brought the economy to its knees. And Iran now needs to find some way of getting out of the nuclear impasse, while very important to everybody, but particularly to Iranians, while maintaining their dignity.
Well, that story is being continued this week, actually. James, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Rob. Thank you very much.
That was James Buchan. His new book is Days of God, The Revolution in Iran and Its Consequences.
Coming up, are humans hardwired for war? You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. In just a few minutes, we'll ask the question, are humans hardwired for war? First, though, Gene Purcell joins me here to talk about our fall membership drive. You've heard Gene on the air before. He's filled in for me. He's filled in for Veronica Rickert. Well, we're here for our fall membership drive. It's the time for you to take action in support of the programs you count on. Become a WPR contributor with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we certainly hope that humans are hardwired to pledge, because we are looking for 30 more pledges in just the next 25 minutes here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is your pledge right now that helps pay for all of the programs you count on all year long. Programs like Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And big thank you, by the way, if you've already given. But if you haven't, there's still plenty of time to do so right now. Please give at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Join us daily on Central Time from 3 to 6. You'll get a wide range of topics to help you with the commute home. Just today, casinos in Wisconsin, revolution in Iran, chocolate in our hands, in our mouths. Lots of great stuff to talk about here on Central Time. Your support makes all this news and information and entertainment possible. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And giving is not a complicated process. We make it as easy as we can possibly make it. All we need are a few things. We'll need your name, your contact information, how we can get a hold of you, the amount of your pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio, and then how you'd like to pay for it.
Save a little time and money, use a credit card if you can, or here's the best thing, start automatic, sustaining donations directly from your bank account. You choose how to give, and then you do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Your call is important to us, so please leave a message after the beep. I listen and contribute to Wisconsin Public Radio, and I am an avid fan because Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network programming feeds my head, and the classical music feeds my soul. Thanks, Wisconsin Public Radio, for informing me and enriching my life.
Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 to make your pledge of support during our fall membership drive. Rob Ferret here with Gene Purcell asking for your support of WPR. Thank you in advance for your gift of $5 or $10 or $15 a month. Whatever amount you choose is the right amount. Make your pledge at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
And here's something to think about when you make your pledge today. Think about becoming a sustaining member of Wisconsin Public Radio. As a sustaining member, you'll give a monthly amount, $5 or $10 or $15, whatever works out for you. Then that amount automatically comes out of your bank account or credit card. Your monthly gift will then continue until you ask us to make a change.
It's a big deal because it means we can depend on you the way you depend on us, day in and day out, year in and year out. You're in control. You can change your giving at any time. It's a convenient and easy way to give, and it's super helpful for Wisconsin Public Radio. Become a sustainer right now. Go online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
And super helpful is what you are all about out there in as listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio. You've already made that decision to listen to us here at WPR. Now, what we're asking is for you to make that decision to support Wisconsin Public Radio financially. And really, when you boil it all down, that's about how simple it is. Pledging is simple, too, at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Remember, if you pledge $180 or more, you can get the brand new Wisconsin Public Radio travel mug. Nice, lightweight, metal, solid travel mug with our new logo on it made by Clean Canteen. Yours for a pledge of $15 a month. Not too bad. You support great radio and you get the mug as a thank you gift. Make your pledge right now in any amount at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We've got about 29 pledges to go in about the next 20 minutes, so we've got some work to do, and we'll need your pledge right now to make sure we meet that goal by 6 o'clock. Your support makes the difference here at WPR. It makes all of these great programs possible, and you can be part of making that happen by giving at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Michael from Kenosha pledged. He says, "While I'm a relatively new listener, I have come to appreciate the variety of your programming and excellent news reports."
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you so much, Michael. That's great. We do have an excellent news team here at Wisconsin Public Radio, really keeping on top of the state government issues, but everything else going on in the state as well. Make a pledge on behalf of them and then of the variety of the talk shows here on the Ideas Network. Pledge now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Thanks for your pledge. We'll check in. Hopefully have some good news for you later in the hour. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. There's an age-old question that goes back to ancient philosophers. Are humans inherently warlike? The question has gotten an update from the field of evolutionary psychology, where some researchers argue that we evolved in violent situations, violent times, so violence is hardwired into the way our brains work.
Well, our next guest doesn't buy that line of thinking. David Barish joins us now. He's an evolutionary biologist and a professor of psychology at the University of Washington. His forthcoming book is called Buddhist Biology, Ancient Eastern Wisdom Meets Modern Western Science. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Veronica. Thank you.
So the argument, you know, at first blush, it seems kind of plausible. Our ancient early ancestors lived in violent times. They needed to fight one another to survive, and so we evolved to be warlike. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think it's a plausible argument in some ways. I think it's wrong in two important respects. One is less concerned with the scientific accuracy than with the implications of it. I think it's a very dangerous conception because it tends to support a view, obviously, of human beings as inherently warlike and could really run the risk of leading to what we often call a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is to say, insofar as people are convinced that war is inevitable, that people are inherently warlike, that in itself would dramatically undercut real efforts at peace, because one could say, well, this just goes against human nature and is impossible. It's a waste of time. And the only thing we should do then is build up the largest possible militaries that we can and always assume that war is just around the corner. So that's more that an ethical argument, however, than a scientific one. I think scientifically there are a number of problems. One problem is deriving generalizations about human beings from essentially very limited samples. For instance, it's relatively popular among many of my colleagues, and even more of my students, unfortunately, to say, well, now we know that chimpanzees killed each other, or kill each other. They engage in behaviors very much like war. And so this must be hardwired into our DNA. Whereas the reality is, of course, that there are also bonobos, which are famous for making love, not war. And there's no reason to think that we're any more closely related to chimpanzees than to bonobos.
Well, it's something that's become sort of just a truism in our culture, I think, that, you know, people look at games like football and say, well, we like to battle it out. That's just how we are. And it's not just, you know, military operations. It's just the way we interact sometimes on a daily level. I think that this notion that we are warlike and are warlike by nature is accepted, don't you think?
Well, it's accepted by some people, and I think it's a very inappropriate acceptance, if you will. I think one has to make a distinction between some of the really underlying fundamental inclinations that may well be, to some extent, hardwired. And I think in humans that would include not violence itself. It's not like we are sort of desperate to be violent and all we need is an opportunity, but rather a capacity, an inclination to be violent under certain circumstances. But that's really an individual behavioral trait. Something like war, to be more specific rather than football even, war is a complex social phenomenon in which, in fact, individual anger plays very little part. It's really something that is organized by society. It often involves, in fact, almost always involves, rather complex cognition, planning, even something like the Manhattan Project, which was used at the end of World War II, is hardly a result of intense anger or violence. It's rather a whole lot of deep thinking. And so war itself is a much more elaborate phenomenon and something that is, I think, to a very large extent, imposed upon us, whereas violence, individual violence under certain circumstances, jealousy, self-defense, any number of things, that, I think, is much closer to being hardwired.
What is the case to be made that we could have evolved to be peaceful and collaborative instead of warlike?
Well, exactly. And in fact, I would say that it's not that we could have, but we have evolved to be collaborative, cooperative, and peaceful. And indeed, ironically, even under those complex circumstances when we're making war, war itself requires a lot of collaboration and cooperation, at least among the individuals on any one side. But at the same time, we have evolved a susceptibility to group-oriented violence, which is another way of looking at war. I think that the reality is really, if we try to look at what is evolution's bequeathal to us, it's not simple. And indeed, I think the icon for it is the Roman god Janus, who was the famous two-faced god.
Mm-hmm.
We have January because and the image from the Roman god is of two faces, one looking back to the earlier year, the year that's just ending, and one looking ahead to the one that's coming. And we have that Janus-faced bequeathal from evolution. We can be, and are, remarkably cooperative and looking for nonviolent solutions. At the same time, we are also susceptible to violence. We have a number of buttons, if you will, that can be pushed.
So are you implying that it's a choice?
I think to a very large extent it is a choice. Now, there are various ways of looking at it. For someone like Tolstoy, he emphasized that it's a choice that every individual has to make. He said, for instance, in part of War and Peace, he said, well, Napoleon thinks he's in charge of all this stuff, but he's really not. He's deluding himself. It's really a function of every individual soldier who makes a choice whether or not to participate. And there are a large number who don't. And there are a large number of soldiers who, even during battles, refuse to fire at the enemy, or at least don't fire. On the other hand, it's not completely a choice. Individuals are susceptible to group psychology, groupthink, a kind of collective madness that happens on occasion. But that's not the same as an instinct for war. It's a vulnerability to ways in which we are being manipulated by others. But it's not as though we have this inbred need for war, and if we don't engage in a war over a certain period of time, it sort of bubbles out anyhow. I mean, there are plenty of countries that have never engaged in war, and there are plenty of human societies that do not engage in war. In fact, if I could add another thing, one reason why I was motivated to speak out on this derives specifically from some work of one of my colleagues on the Yanomamo of the Amazon, Napoleon Chagnon, who I know and consider a friend, and I respect his work greatly.
And this is the group of people who live in the Amazon and had been living there for a long time and seemed largely untouched by modern civilization.
That's right. That's right. Although there are some claims that Knapp himself introduced some things like steel-edged tools that may have influenced their behavior. But I think, his work was controversial, but I think, frankly, that he's an excellent scientist and his reports are accurate. And he famously described the Yanomamo as the fierce people who were almost constantly engaged in inter-village skirmishes that are kind of the non-technological equivalent of war. The problem is, and I don't believe that Chagnon himself did this, but the problem is that many others have taken this one example of the Yanomamo and imagined that somehow they stood for all humanity, whereas, in fact, there are lots of other human groups relatively untouched by Western society who are very peaceful, who don't engage in anything like war. They may have acts of individual violence for one reason or another, but there's no war at all, and they're every bit as human as the Yanomamo.
Now, you wrote about this as a piece in the New York Times in response, you know, to the assumption that we are evolutionarily biased toward war. What has been the response? Are you getting any traction with evolutionary biologists?
Well, actually, most of the response I've gotten has been from the public who are not scientists and who have actually been very grateful. I've heard relatively little from my colleagues, and I think that some of them feel that I have somehow deserted them, because in fact, in a large part of my own research, I do talk about at least the theoretical concepts of human adaptive behavior, which I think is very important, ways in which we are influenced by our underlying genes. But I think there's been a tendency to go too far with it in a way that it's not only unscientific, but that risks being unethical in terms of its consequences. Again, I think there's in science alone, we're always taught not to generalize from a sample size that's very small. And there's been an awful lot of generalizations from the Yanomamo alone. And I fear that people, particularly with a right-wing militaristic bent, are inclined to grasp onto this one example and say, see, this is how we all are. And I think it's analogous to, let's say you were in Australia and you see a platypus, and you say, all mammals lay eggs. Well, no, some mammals lay eggs.
Okay, well,
lots of them that don't.
Let's leave it there. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome, Veronica. I enjoyed it.
That was David Barish, an evolutionary biologist and a professor of psychology at the University of Washington. His forthcoming book is called Buddhist Biology.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret with Veronica Rickert, and this is the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive. You count on WPR for great discussions, and your gift of any amount makes these discussions possible. Give now at WPR.org or call 888 202 2552.
Help pay for the programs that you listen to and that you depend on. We are looking for 27 more pledges in about the next 6 minutes. You can make your donation now. Help us reach this hourly goal at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Another thought-provoking conversation there on the borders of evolution, psychology, and philosophy, really. Now make a few minutes to make this hour and many more hours possible. Choose a gift amount that works for you, and then make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you've never done it before, giving takes just a few minutes of your time. You just tell us your name, you give us your contact information. You have to decide how much you'd like to give and how you'd like to pay. And when you use your credit card, it does save a bit of time, postage, and paper and puts your money to work right away. But no matter how you choose to give or how much you choose to give, use the next few minutes to make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you're thinking your tax dollars, federal and state, already support WPR, you're right. They do, and really, we do thank you for that.
But contributions from individual listeners make the quality and variety of programs you're used to on Wisconsin Public Radio possible. Listener support is the single largest piece of our budget pie, and you make the difference. Because WPR matters to you, matters in your life, is part of the daily fabric of how you learn about the world. Make a personal contribution to pay for the radio programs you listen to at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Just a few minutes left of Central Time today, and this is tomorrow's the last day of Central Time during the pledge drive. Not a lot of time left to make your contribution. Make it now. Support great public radio at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Right now, Wisconsin Public Radio is my wake-up in the morning. Joy Cardine takes me to work in the morning. It kind of gets me revved up if she's talking about an issue I'm passionate about. It gets me ready to go in the morning. And then on the way home, I'm really getting to like Central Time, and that takes me home at night. Honestly, I was listening to the WPR, I think it was the fall membership drive when I joined, and it was during Joy Cardine's show. I was on my way into work, and I was listening to these stories from other listeners, and I thought, you know, that should be me. I should be doing the same thing. As soon as I got into work, I got on the website and I contributed. I'm Bridget from Oak Creek, Wisconsin. I enjoy being a WPR sustainer, and I think you will too.
Well, you heard Bridget's story. Does that sound like you? Do you wake up with Joy Cardine and drive home with Central Time? If so, and if you haven't pledged before, make that donation in support of those programs at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. It's Central Time. Rob Ferret here with Veronica Rickert asking for your gift. It's listener support that makes Wisconsin Public Radio happen. Whether you pledge $5 a month, or $100 a month, or anywhere in between, it really does make a difference.
New members are really important to Wisconsin Public Radio, so we want to thank you and welcome all the first-time donors who have pledged so far this hour, and that is 5 new listeners so far. The more people who support Wisconsin Public Radio, the better we're able to deal with the economic ups and downs.
If you've never given before, know that your new membership will help keep Wisconsin Public Radio the strong, reliable station that you depend on. You decide the amount. One example, how about $5 a month? And then give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You love Wisconsin Public Radio because it's your source for intelligent radio. Well, there are bills associated with high-quality radio, but that's where you come in. Your support is so important to
us. Making a pledge is quick and easy. You'll be finished in no time at all. Your contribution in any amount, $5 or $10 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes WPR possible.
If you can, share your passion for WPR by making a pledge of $100 a month. We rely on member support, your support, to make great radio. Your gift of $100 a month or $1,200 for the year is incredibly helpful. Of course, every pledge, no matter the amount, is appreciated. It makes you a member of WPR at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Angie from Beaver Dam pledged. She says, I depend on the Ideas Network every day, all day, to keep me up to date with thorough information about what's happening in the state and nation. Thank you, she says, WPR. Thank you, Angie. We heard from Heather in Green Bay. She says, I've come to appreciate the top-notch hosts. Thank you, WPR has. You guys truly are the best around. Do you agree? Well, make that pledge right now. Pledge through the news, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You make a difference with your pledge. Right now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and thank you.